Nope. Just Tony Beam so far. Austin Barker is hot-footing it up here, so he'll be here in a few minutes. This is Tony Beam, Director of Church and Community Engagement for the Tim Brazier Campus of North Greenville University, where Christ makes the difference. And I also serve as Director of Public Policy for the South Carolina Baptist Convention, which, by the way, the Southern Baptist Convention is coming up in Nashville a week from Monday. Yeah. I'll be leaving on Saturday to head to Nashville. So I'll be broadcasting kind of like I did when I was there in Nashville before for the ERLC Academy. And so I'll be probably sitting in a hotel room 6 o'clock in the morning because we got an hour difference in the time. And I'll be Austin will be here and I'll be there. So we'll continue to do the show for you. We've got a special guest today. We have Josh Kimbrell. Senator Kimbrell is going to join us at 8:05 this morning. In fact, he said that he's going to be in the studio because he's going to be in Greenville today for a meeting. So he's going to come in and actually be here. You'll be able to see him on Facebook Live, which would be good. Good morning, by the way, to everybody over there on Facebook Live. Thanks for tuning in. Can't talk today. That's going to be bad because when you're doing talk radio, talking is an essential element of that. All right. I was trying to figure out where to start today. Ah, here comes Austin. I think I'm going to start with this simply because I don't hear this as much as I used to, but I'm still hearing this drumbeat from different places that Donald Trump is going to be reinstated as president of the United States by August. Now, this is the latest iteration of, you know, after the election, Trump said he was going to win. When it became obvious that he was not going to win, the election was stolen. And then, you know, I'm going to be, all this is going to get worked out. The theories, the conspiracy theories that just ran wild. Probably January, February, March, even after Biden was inaugurated. The president will be back by March. He's going to be back by February. Then it was March. Then it was April. Well, now we're up to the president's going to be reinstated, President Trump, and Martha McSally will be reinstated as a senator from Arizona. And David Perdue is going to be reinstated as a senator from Georgia. So this is broadly, and here's the source of this, by the way, is President Trump. He's the one that's telling people this. Now, Maggie Habermas reported this. She's a writer for the New York Times. And a lot of people have kind of, you know, dismissed this. Even conservatives are saying, no, Trump doesn't believe this. But the people around him are saying squarely that he is pushing this story hard, that he will be reinstated by August, that all of these, as you know, there's a not an official recount, but an audit, let's call it that, an audit going on in Arizona. There's one going on in Wisconsin, actually several. What's happening in Wisconsin is more of an examination of how outside money influenced the races, which is, it's important for the people of Wisconsin to wake up, smell the coffee, and figure that out, that their votes got nullified by millions of dollars being spent by Zuckerberg that was supposed to go to voting, initiatives to get out the vote everywhere, and it ended up landing in heavily Democrat districts getting out the Democrat vote. So that's kind of the way this is being looked at in Wisconsin. But in other states, Nevada, they're looking at vote counts. Georgia, again. But here's the thing. Let's say that it was proven beyond the shadow of a doubt that descendants of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, not Hugo Chavez. Hugo Chavez is no longer there. But let's just say that descendants of Chavez worked with some other shadowy group, and it's proven beyond the shadow of a doubt that millions of votes were turned and that the election, as people have stated, was stolen, and that becomes undeniable fact. Even if that happened, which it's not going to happen, but even if it did, Donald Trump would not be reinstated as president. There is no mechanism in the U.S. Constitution. There is no path of reinstatement. Once an election is certified and all of that, Congress has done their job, each state has done its job, then that's it. The next president will be elected in 2024 unless Joe Biden is impeached or, God forbid, something happens to him and it becomes Kamala Harris. I mean, who's the president? That's when the opportunity for a new president will present itself, barring those things that I just mentioned. But Donald Trump is not going to be reinstated. So if people are holding on to that, you need to let that go, because there is no possibility of that taking place. None. Zero. Zip. Nada. So even though the president himself is pushing this now, and I don't know why he may believe it. You know, once the president embraces something, and by the way, this doesn't mean that I'm not sitting here telling you that Donald Trump is mentally unstable or that he hasn't done good things or that he doesn't say things. He's said some things since he got his from the desk of Donald J. Trump. By the way, that lasted less than a month. He took down that portion of his website, the part that was supposed to be the social, you know, he was going to make his pronouncements from
there. From the desk of Donald Trump.
From the desk. What did I say?
You might have said that.
Did I say that? Okay, yeah. From the desk of Donald Trump. So they took that down already. Now, they're teasing that's anticipation of some other much larger project that's about to be launched.
But the teasing of that came from Jason Miller.
And it could be. Yeah.
It was almost, it felt to me, and I wasn't there, and so I didn't hear the whole context of the conversation, but it almost felt to me like the media suggested that. So is this like a precursor to some bigger social media platform? He's like, yes.
Yeah, no, I know.
Of course it is.
And we don't, I don't have any, I have no idea one way or the other what that's all about.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to speculate because I just don't know. Here's what I know. When this was launched, it was ballyhooed as being Trump's, you know, return to social media, and it lasted less than a month.
And drew a meager audience.
Yeah, it was not. Well, it wasn't very robust. I mean, I don't think that's evidence that Trump's appeal, particularly within the Republican Party, is waning.
I was hoping.
Well, I know. But I'm just looking at it from a factual standpoint. I don't, because of the nature of what it was, where it was located, all of that, I don't think we can judge anything by that. And whether he's going to come out, I mean, time will tell. I mean, it's just like after the election when, you know, we were going to, was it Sidney Powell was going to release the Kraken, and I kept waiting for the Kraken. We had a Kraken party here, where we set up things that we thought the Kraken might enjoy if the Kraken actually appeared. So that if the Kraken came, he would actually, because I wanted to interview the Kraken, have him on the show. And the Kraken never appeared. So,
should we have a Yoda party next? Is that what we're doing?
Well, now, don't get off on Yoda, because we don't want to get crossways. It's only 7:15. So, anyway... I just thought I would put that out there because, and with all due respect, I wish Donald Trump had won the election. We would be much better off with Donald Trump as president. I supported him. I voted for him.
Let's say we would be less bad off.
No. We would be much better off. I mean, I have no qualms about saying we would be much better off with Donald Trump as president, because Joe Biden is a dumpster fire on the Titanic. I mean, you can imagine that, right? Look, there's a fire over here, while your people are running by in their life jackets, jumping into lifeboats or into the ocean. That's really what it is. But this is not the path. So let us let us let go of this, those that are holding on to it, and let's look to the future and figure out how the Republican Party and how people who hold traditional values can regain a foothold, can get the levers of power back from these totalitarians that are systematically trying to dismantle the country. You know, it's really too bad, honestly, and you're going to think I'm nuts when I say this, but hear me out. We would have been better off if Kamala Harris was at the top of the ticket, if she was actually president, because she is so terrible. I mean, you realize her approval ratings are abysmal, and it's because she's terrible. And that, you know, it's so obvious how far left she is with every time she opens her mouth. The problem with Biden is that he's still good old Uncle Joe. Good old Joe. He's the good old moderate. He's the face. I mean, he's not. The policies that are coming out of Washington are incredibly destructive, progressive, totalitarian, whatever word you want to use to describe it. But when people look at him and hear him and the way the press portrays him, they can get away with, you know, making Joe this some kind of kindly grandfather who's leading our country, you know, and we don't have to worry. Don't pay any attention to all this left-wing nonsense over here, but just keep your eyes on good old Joe.
Can I give you an example of that?
Yeah.
Joe, the abortion lobby is very exercised about the fact that Joe Biden has not used the word abortion since he has in public since he's been elected. There's actually a tracker for how many days it's been since Joe Biden has said the word abortion publicly. And so that's part of, and I personally think that because of Biden's Catholic roots and the fact that he does seem to take his faith at some level somewhat seriously, I don't know, you know, obviously there's a contradiction in there, but because of his Catholic faith and because of the pressure that's coming on him from the Catholic bishops and, you know, the possibility of his being denied communion because of his positions on abortion, I think there is an internal contradiction even within him. And that's manifesting itself in the fact that he's unwilling to mouth the word abortion. He always couches it in women's rights or reproductive rights or whatever word euphemistically he wants to apply to that. Yeah. But he won't come out and say the word abortion because there's still a stigma attached to the word abortion. And whatever the abortion lobby does to try and get rid of that stigma, it's not working. And so you hear that in Joe Biden's reluctance to use the word.
Yeah, but his reluctance doesn't reflect any kind of internal conflict.
You think it's
between
just a political?
It's purely political because Joe Biden is purely political. His Catholicism is simply a add-on to whatever else he uses to gain political advantage. He wants Catholics to vote for him. He doesn't want to alienate all Catholics. So. No, I don't. I mean, I just don't. I don't think there's anything.
You don't think he takes his faith seriously at all?
No. Huh,
that's interesting. I think he does. Because I have to take him for what he says. I guess you could say he's lying about his faith. Like
he's
he
lying
lies
about
other
his,
stuff.
Yeah. He's lying about his faith. Hmm. I mean, how can you take your faith seriously when nothing about your faith that contradicts public policy? He doesn't take any positions that would reflect his faith as opposed to what about same sex, you know, what about transgenderism? What about, I mean, nothing about the Catholic teaching does he reflect. Nothing. And so that's not taking your faith seriously. There's no, if he's got some kind of conflict, he may feel conviction in some degree, but I think he killed that off a long time ago. For political purposes. Kudos to Democrat delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton from Washington, D.C. Now, she's a delegate because she's not a voting member of Congress. I don't know if you know that the D.C. area allows for the selection of a delegate, somebody that kind of can observe and make speeches and try to influence Congress, but they can't vote on anything. But I've got to hand it to her, because she has put her finger on a problem in our country that I doubt few people have thought about. In fact, I can guarantee you that my co-host this morning and my producer, that Gary Miller nor Austin Barker have ever given any thought to this issue, and it's because they're sexist, both of them. And I've been convicted. When I read this story from Eleanor Holmes Norton, I was convicted about my own sexism, my own lack of concern for female dummies. I mean, finally, somebody has come out and said what this country needs is more female dummies. Because every crash dummy that's used in testing seatbelts in the automobile industry are male. And thanks to Eleanor Holmes Norton, this is going to get remedied. She is recommending to Congress that there is a law that Congress passes legislation that addresses this inequity in crash dummies. That somehow we pass a law that says that there has to be an equal number of female crash dummies that are used in testing of automobiles. Now, I'll tell you, and she says it's clear sexism. And I have to agree. Can you imagine any other industry where there are no females? I mean, and by the way, if men can be dummies, why should women not be dummies? Now, the problem here that I would ask her is that how does she know that some of these male dummies don't identify as female? How does she know the gender of these crash dummies? I mean, you know, the Crash Dummy Union hasn't come out and spoken about this yet. They haven't. And I'm surprised, because I would think that there would be an immediate response that male crash dummies that identify as female would already be kicking up a stink. And yet, we hear nothing from them. So,
I thought for a minute that I thought surely there's not an issue out there that I have not given some attention and thought to. But you were 100% right.
I told you.
Never thought about subjecting. And now that I do, I think my compassionate side kicks in, and I feel bad, literally on a principled basis, that Eleanor Holmes Norton wants to subject female crash dummies to situations that are inevitably going to cause them harm.
Absolutely. What happens to these crash dummies? She is right.
If males have the opportunity to go out there and be savaged in a brutal car wreck,
right,
females should have the same right.
I agree. I think, you know, this is one feminist ought to be outraged all over this country, that there haven't been female, that there are no female dummies. Now, I'm going to tread lightly here, because the depth of trouble that this could cause me in my personal life could be immense. But I would argue that there are female dummies.
I thought you weren't going to say it, actually. Like, I thought that's what you were going to say, and I thought that you wouldn't.
Well, if there are male dummies, I mean, I'm offended that I can be referred to, you would refer to this as a male dummy. See, that's the next thing. They need to change the whole structure of what they call these male crash survivors, male crash test pilots.
Victims.
Whatever. Yeah, yep. Victims. Then they could become Democrats. If they're labeled as victims, they can become Democrats.
As long as they're dummies, they're solidly in the Republican camp.
Oh, no. Well, yeah, according to the media.
According to the media.
But if they were labeled as victims, then they could form a voting bloc.
That's true.
That could be a problem, because I don't know how many of these dummies there are.
We could probably get them to vote.
Of course, the more and more, well, I'm sure some already have. We just don't know.
Hey, Gene, we're kidding about this whole thing.
Yeah,
okay?
This is a joke. This is a joke. Yeah. But this story's not a joke. I mean, here's a statement. You can't make this up. I want to go back to Guam tipping over, but here we go. Women have achieved equality. I was going to do my best to get through this without just losing it. Women have achieved equality on the road when it comes to driving, but when it comes to safety testing to keep them safe on the road, they are nowhere near achieving equality. You do understand that test dummies are essentially genderless. I mean,
not entirely. When they first designed test dummies, they actually based them on the 50th percentile male, because that was they were trying to hit the average, you know, in terms of how people would respond in an impact situation.
But there's no, I mean, the stuff that they test is not going to be any different if they put anatomically female parts on these crash dummies. There's not going to be there's nothing that is going to change on whether you hit the windshield, whether you go through. Now,
and you said I was sexist?
No, well, I'm telling you. There's so many problems here. A, we don't know how many of these crash dummies, you know, identify as female. B, we don't know whether these male crash dummies would actually how they would interact with female crash dummies, what that would do to the data
and unit cohesion too. You have to think about unit cohesion.
Because you can imagine when these male crash dummies
are
being
a lot of
strapped in
going on.
Plus the male crash dummy, because of the innate desire to protect
this
female
sexist desire.
Can you imagine?
Yes.
He's gonna throw himself over in front of the female when the car hits the wall.
Skew the results.
And we're not going to have a clue about what's actually taking place in the car.
In the real world, where men are told not to behave in that type of behavior.
Right.
That chauvinistic, sexist behavior.
That's right. They're supposed to let the women on their own.
Because women are strong.
What are you going to do about maternity leave for female crash dummies? I mean, if you allow them into the, then you're going to have to, you know,
I'm offering an amendment to that, though, because I think we need paternity leave, too.
You know what's going to happen with these male dummies and these female dummies? Eventually, they're going to create baby dummies. And there's going to be, now you're going to have the abortion industry get involved.
Are you saying we're going to have a bunch of little dummies running around?
That's what we're going to have. Oh, wait a minute. We've already got Congress. I'm sorry. I forgot. I apologize to William Timmons and Jeff Duncan. I'm just teasing. Okay,
I
guess
like the best story for a Friday ever.
I don't know.
But if it wasn't grounded in reality, it wouldn't
have quite the
humor. It's like it's legit. Gender equality is the standard
for crash dummies. Now you would think, first of all, if you're a crash dummy, I'm not sure that you deserve any kind of special consideration, because that pretty much says it all. I mean, you're allowing yourself to be strapped into a car to it. They're not real, okay? Let me go back for those of you who may be saying, but you mean people actually? No, these are real dummies, okay? Norton's office claimed that male-only dummies could not adequately provide the data to show how women's crash reactions would differ from those of men.
Exactly how would women differ?
I mean, I get what
the open mouth, the open mouth scream,
the scream factor.
Does glass get in your mouth when you scream? Is that how it's different?
Is this Monsters Incorporated, where the scream becomes the energy that propels the city or whatever? They pointed to differences in anatomy. You know, I'm surprised. How can she say that?
How is that even? How is that politically correct for a Democrat to mouth those words?
Exactly. I mean, she should be. This ought to be trending on Twitter. That she actually suggests that there's a difference between male and female. She is transphobic. I mean, the transgender community ought to be up in arms about this. And the crash dummy community, too, actually. They pointed to differences in anatomy as well as average neck strength. Average neck strength. So, in other words, men have stronger necks. Therefore,
hold on.
I
think we just found our first U.S. congressional co-sponsor of a Save Our Women's Sports Bill.
Absolutely, because this is a Democrat admitting that male crash dummies have stronger necks than female crash dummies would have. I'm astounded. I think this ought to be used. You wait until I testify again before the Senate subcommittee. I'm going to bring this information to light. I'm glad this has come out because like I said, this is a scandal.
I recommend bringing props with you. You know how they always do, and they put up these big charts and stuff. You bringing in a female crash test dummy with you?
No, there aren't any.
Well,
make one. I guess
long,
I could.
Just put some long hair on it, you know, so those sexist stereotypes. Put some female anatomy on it.
A little makeup, maybe, you know. You could have a Gucci bag over the shoulder. That could be a guy. Okay, Reggie, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I concur on the John Fogerty Friday. I would agree with the female crash test dummy only if whenever you change lanes, the legs come flying up and the arms flail and they have some kind of a disparaging mark for the driver. And once it crashes, then it's they're somewhere hidden on the – it was his fault.
Yeah.
He was driving too fast.
You can put the bumper sticker on the back of the crash car.
Hey, there you go.
No, I know. Hey, we could come up with all – they're all kind of female driving jokes that would just make us totally sexist. But, I mean, really, women have been spared female crash dummy jokes from driving. Why in the world would we want to subject them to that? I mean, they've been protected from it. You imagine the female crash dummy putting makeup on, going, you know, while the car is going down the thing. Oh, come on. Don't tell me that you haven't seen. I've seen that.
Oh, yes, I have.
How many times have I seen that?
Both hands in the air.
Exactly. And I'm not talking about sitting at a traffic light. I'm talking about starting off with. I mean, it amazes me.
Fixing their blonde hair?
Yeah, that's one thing that men. I didn't say. That's Gary Miller at his radio.
I thought you were going to put that on the dummy.
No. No,
blonde wig?
No. That's Gary Miller at his radio.net. Okay?
I'm standing up for the women. How ridiculous is it?
Right. Okay. There's another story here I want to get to today because seriously, this is an important story. If we're going to win when it comes to all these things that are coming down the pike, we've got to learn how to organize as grassroots, and we've got to learn how to channel properly and professionally some of the outrage that we feel. The problem is that a lot of times when we get outraged about something, the outrage doesn't lead to action. It does, and if it does lead to action, it leads to spontaneous knee-jerk responses that don't get us anywhere. Okay? And that's not going to be good enough to push back against things like critical race theory being introduced into schools. It's going to take people at the grassroots level being organized, being professional, being smart about how they respond. And we've got a great example. I want to tell you, Rich Lowry has a great article at National Review, and the title is How South Lake, Texas Won Its Battle Against Critical Race Theory. And I want to just give you some of the details here. At the end of July last year, word began to spread of a quiet effort by the school board in Southlake to pass a so-called cultural competence action plan, which was critical race theory with a different label. I mean, they didn't, you know, now they were smart enough. Here's credit to the people that wanted to get critical race theory into the school. They knew that if they called it critical race theory, it was going to cause a hubbub. So they came up with the Cultural Competence Action Plan. But the people who saw this knew that it was critical race theory. The parents looked at this and said, this is teaching our kids that it's racist to be a white person. And so the outrage, listen to this next paragraph by Lowry. The outrage was instant and, as it turns out, highly consequential. Opponents of the plan eventually swept the school board races last month, garnering national attention and giving opponents of critical race theory a signature of victory at the local level. So how did this happen? Well, the opposition was spontaneous. It was genuinely grassroots, but it was not amateurish. Now, and this is what happens so often. We get grassroots efforts that are not concentrated. They're not coordinated. They don't speak well. They just go off in a direction. It takes a little bit of time. Everybody needs to, when something like this happens, we need a deep breath of contemplation at the same time that we're responding. Responding initially means getting together, pooling resources, sharing ideas, and inspiring each other to really push back against this stuff. While there's no substitute for having inflamed public opinion on your side, it has to be appropriately channeled. The South Lake opposition was unified, carefully organized, and never took its eye off the ball. If we want to get Save Women's Sports passed in South Carolina, we've got to have those three elements. We've got to be unified, organized, and we have to keep our eye on the ball. What is the ball in that case? It's getting Save Women's Sports legislation passed in South Carolina. And we need to add college sports because we need to be as bold as Ron DeSantis when it comes to the NCAA and saying, you know, we'll tell you where your tournaments can be. But if they're not going to be in Florida, we don't care. So the other stage of this, not only was it unified, organized, and focused, it was also fearless. Now here's because these outspoken and resolute people endured harassment. They endured the threat of getting fired from their jobs, and they just kept moving. They encouraged each other. They stood by each other, and they never stopped speaking out, no matter what. You see, the left knows something about people on the right. People on the right are decent, hardworking, everyday American citizens who keep the country running. And at the end of the day, we just want to be left alone. We want to raise our families. We want to go to church. We want to serve the Lord. We want to be good citizens, but we don't want to have to go to war every other day. And so when they come swooping in with some type of left-wing, progressive, totalitarian attempt to steamroll the people in a community, there's immediate, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? And then there's just...
Let's have a meeting.
Yeah, well,
we right. need to have a meeting.
Well, and they do need to have a meeting.
They do.
But the meeting has to produce something.
That's it.
And then they've got to be, you know, everybody's got to lock arms and say, not on my watch. This isn't happening.
But the thing is, Tony, you've got to say that every single day.
Every
day. You've
got
to do it for years. It's called a long obedience in the same direction.
Right.
Faithfulness, persistent, long-term
right.
faithfulness. Because that's the problem. Proverbs says the hand of the diligent shall rule.
Well, yes.
So,
very good.
If you're not up to the job, if you're not going to stay at the job, then don't cry
don't
and moan
up.
When the
right.
other side wins.
Right.
Because trust me, the LGBTQ agenda, secularism, are... ideological opponents are very resolute, and they
right.
are very diligent.
Right.
They're at it.
No, I agree 100%. And we have to, but in Southlake, these people got serious. They supported each other. They focused on what the major issue was. They didn't get sidetracked. They didn't start nipping in each other's heels. They stayed unified, and they won an incredible victory. I mean, they squashed this. They voted out of office every school board member who wanted any of this to be implemented on the children of South Lake. And that's what it's going to take in South Carolina. We did a pretty good job back in November of putting some good people in Columbia. But now to motivate these, if we're going to have Save Women's Sports, if we're going to have freedom of conscience when it comes to counseling, when it comes to the idea that pastors and counselors should be able to talk to young people if their parents approve, to be able to talk to young people about transgender and same-sex attraction issues, you know, right? This legislation in Columbia which is going to come up for a vote again. I told you they weren't going to go away. They delayed the vote to try to let the heat dissipate, but they're coming back Tuesday, June 14th, and they're going to try to pass this ordinance again in Columbia that would prevent parents from allowing their minor children to be counseled about transgender or same-sex issues. So, you know, we had this conversation yesterday, not here on the show, but I had it with some other people. And we've got to have this, you know, people have to know about this. They have to be outraged, but that outrage can't just be scattered. It has to be focused in a coherent, well thought out response. And I'm hoping that's going to happen in this case. Whether it does or not, you know, I don't know. But South Carolina, if we're going to see change, that's the way it's going to come. This has been making the rounds. And I'm sympathetic to people in Oregon that want to secede from Oregon and join Idaho. And there's a whole movement called Let Us Go. And the coolest thing about this is that it was conceived and put forth by a couple of guys that get together and have breakfast and have coffee. And they were just sitting around talking about how good would it be to get out of Oregon. Northeast Oregon or Northwest Oregon politically rules the state, and the rural areas of Oregon are so removed, so different than the political powers that run the state. So they're going to try to secede and join Idaho, become part of Idaho. Now, this has been suggested before for California. Actually, in California, the suggestion was that you split into two states or possibly three states instead of having just the state of California. But I wanted to say, while I empathize with these folks in Oregon, and I cheer them on, and I wish them the best, and I hope that they succeed, because I think it would just be a great thing if people were able to come together and say, if our government is totally non-representative of who we are, and we've got an opportunity to go over here and join with people that are in tune with who we are, then why not? That's what I would say. We were talking about a state. Or a portion of the state. But here's what has to happen. And that's why I'd like for this program to not only be about philosophy and Christian worldview and stuff that's going on, but kind of grasping the truth about it. It would be a miracle if this actually happened. The secession leaders need to get the approval of two legislatures. In other words, Oregon would have to say, okay, you can go. Idaho would have to say, okay, come on. Oregon, of course, is dominated by Democrats. Idaho is dominated by Republicans. So the two states would have to undergo a divvying up of assets and debts, as well as debate taxes, pensions, drug laws, other issues. And then you would have to have the United States Congress. You would have to have, not only would this have to go through the two states, but Congress would have to agree, and it would have the chances of this happening are really slim. But I'm not suggesting that they shouldn't try, because just because something's hard doesn't mean that principled people shouldn't attempt it if the end goal is going to make their lives better and it's going to give them an opportunity to embrace the truth over that false totalitarian narrative that gets spouted out in Oregon all the time.
Yeah, I spent 12 years of my life in Oregon, Central Oregon, conservative part, and you're right, it's the whole Western Corridor, the Interstate 5 Corridor, all the way from Portland to Eugene,
yeah,
that just dominates the state. And the only way that they can get this through is to somehow persuade the liberals in Oregon that it's in their best interest to let them go. They have to make it in their interest.
Right.
And I don't know that there's any argument for that.
Well,
I don't know what Oregon stands to gain by losing half the state. I don't think there's anything really there for them.
I think they would rather rule the conservatives than to let them go. I mean, I just think it's a that, you know, you're right. I don't know how to improve on that, because there is no advantage to them, other than it just wouldn't be a thorn in their side anymore. Come on, be good guys and let us have our way. Progressives getting on board with that? Don't hold your breath.